Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Today we're talking about not what I said we were going to be talking about on the subreddit. What do I mean by that? I accidentally named... My book almost fell off the table. Yesterday I accidentally named the discussion post the complete wrong thing. I named it Part 2, Chapter 36. We all know there is no Part 2, Chapter 36. What kind of madness is that? It was meant to be called Part 3, Chapter 1. That's what we're talking about today. Anna Karenina, Part 3, Chapter 1. Levin is rapt to have his brother round. I think I actually meant to write... Levin isn't rapt to have his brother around. Doesn't seem too happy that his brother's there. Why is Tolstoy so adamantly stressing their differing views on country life? Tekrific answered that one, saying, to create tension and emphasize their differences. Levin is busy with all the farm work that the beginning of summer entails, and his brother is... is viewing all this from the perspective of an outsider looking at a quaint but picturesque environment that he's emotionally and intellectually distant from. It's hard not to see Tolstoy's true colours here. The intellectuals create problems while the farmers feed and clothe people. Again, we see Tolstoy making a judgment on the life of the intellectual as someone far removed from the harsh reality of the people they're so fond of speaking in the name of. Sluggy with 3Gs says, I think that is a good point. Their discussion about the peasantry was also pretty revealing. Levin's brother views the peasantry through a lens of idealism. Despite him claiming to love the peasantry, he clearly thinks of himself as different, and thus can hold this romantic view of them. Levin, on the other hand, sees them as people and finds it impossible to generalize about the peasantry because to him it is the same as just generalizing about people. He also finds it hard to be romantic about the country like his brother because he is steeping in the hard work and reality of it, while his brother only sees it as a place for rest and relaxation. Swim said the mama fishy said, I agree with what everyone is saying, but there is another dynamic at play here. Sergei is Levin's older brother. As a younger sister with an older sister, I never win discussions, and I always have to entertain her when she visits. Nifty Refik said, lol. I'm the older sister, and I pester my younger sister often, especially for her soul food, cooking leftovers, and coffee. It always tastes better when someone makes it for you. She is like my little sister mother. I'm the Sergei, lounging in the sun from mental exercise. Well, I don't know what I am to my older brother. He makes the coffee when I go to visit, every time. I don't know. The relationship here between Levin and his brother, whose name escapes me, doesn't really strike any kind of a chord with me. It doesn't really ring true. But hey, I suppose every person is different. I am Norwegian said, I felt the blurred lines between part one and part two, I felt the same way. My first thought when I reached part three was, wait, where was part two? Also, I only watched the Watchmen movie. You only watched the movie. That's blasphemy. The movie was okay, but yeah, it was an okay adaptation of one of the best books of all time, is what it was. So yeah, no, the book is a whole different thing. You got to read the book, man. It's a whole different thing. Even if you're not a comics person, see, I'm not a comics person. Don't read many comics at all, but the Watchmen graphic novel, very readable, very, very entertaining. Really, really good. Ivan Norwegian says, this is actually referring to yesterday's episode when we were talking about the TV show The Boys. I really agree with you about how the show devolves into melodramatic soap operas nowadays. That's the reason for why I've started dropping so many shows in recent years, especially Netflix ones, where they have 5 hours of story and 13-hour-long episodes to fill. Yeah, you see it more and more, don't you? And the other thing you see is this new format where, you know, think of a season of a TV show traditionally, like, you know, 5 years ago watching a TV show. What's one that comes to mind? Breaking Bad, or The Sopranos, or any of those ones where you've got like season arcs and then multiple seasons to make a larger arc. But a season story arc, think of season whatever of that show, the second last episode in that season, right? The second last episode in a season of a TV show is always very distinct because it's the biggest cliffhanger kind of thing. At the end of the second last episode, it sets it up to be like, in the next episode, we see what happens. Like, we get to the end of this story arc. So, the second last episode always is the one that leaves you hanging the most. Now, the new model is, like, the second last... What would have been the second last episode in the season is now just the last episode in the season. And so, a season of a TV show just ends midway through, like, the climax of the show, pretty much. Like, it'll just drop you there with everything unresolved. And the idea is, like, it's very unsatisfying and it makes you want the next season. Like, oh my god, I need to know what happens next season. It's because they didn't end the story arc. But the thing is, it's not... First of all, you're not telling a full story. You're telling 95% of the story and then leaving out the ending, which is a very frustrating thing to do. And you're only doing that not because it's better for the viewer, but because it gives you a better chance of getting season two made, because there'll be demand for it, because people want to know what happened. But you can't... I think they're shooting themselves in the foot, because it's happened to me with so many shows on Netflix especially, where I get to the last episode and I'm dying to know what happens, and then the season ends and you don't find out what happened. You have to, you know, tune in next season. It's a bad model, because then I just go, well, I'm not going to watch the next season and then just end up feeling the same way again. And also to me, it's like, well, it's a massive blow to the quality of the writing to me. So even if I enjoyed every single minute of that entire season until it ended, if it ends in an unsatisfying way, I then go, eh, right? Or I get angry, like, oh, screw you guys. Like, don't torture me with the ending just so that you got a better chance of making season two. So I think if you want a better chance of making season two of a show, you should just make it a good show. And making it a good show includes giving a season a story arc that ends within that season. I think this model goes back to The Hobbit. Those movies, The Hobbit, what they did there with The Hobbit. In those movies where the one with Smaug, I think it's the second one, Smaug, however you say it, the dragon is flying to the town and it's gonna attack the town, and they're sort of like fortifying their defenses and everything, and you're like, oh my god, this dragon is about to attack a town, this is gonna be awesome. And then the movie ends, and then the start of the next film is that scene. It starts with the dragon attacking the town. It should have been the climax of the scene of the movie before, but they wanted you to come and watch the next one, so they leave you hanging. And it kind of started a trend. TV shows were kind of like, ooh, hang on, there's an idea. Anyway, what am I ranting about this for? What are we meant to be talking about? Tolstoy. Yeah, I'm just upset because there's so many potentially good TV shows, but now they're kind of resorting to like cheap tricks, and I don't like it. And that melodramatic soap opera stuff is just another one of their cheap tricks. I suppose I'm a writer, right? You guys all know that I write books, so things like that annoy me. They probably annoy everyone though. Let's read some actual stuff about Anna Karenina. I loved Levin describing the difference between himself and his brother. It reminded me of the undiscovered self by Jung. Levin looks at these people as what they are, unique and complicated. To say that you understand them doesn't make much sense, but Sergei has defined and quantified them. He understands them all. He is a man of ideas and abstractions working towards the betterment of humanity, a planner who can only achieve his understanding through simplifying and devolving man. Here's what Jung had to say about this increasing trend towards understanding the world as a planner would. By the way, this is I Am Norwegian's comment that I'm reading. Well, this is Jung, but yeah. We ought not to underestimate the psychological effect of the statistical world picture. It displaces the individual in favor of anonymous units that pile up into mass formations. Science supplies us with, instead of the concrete individual, the names of organizations and, at the highest point, the abstract idea of the state as the principle of political reality. The moral responsibility of the individual is then inevitably replaced by the policy of the state, raison d'etat. Instead of moral and mental differentiation of the individual, you have public welfare and the raising of the living standard. The goal and meaning of individual life, which is the only real life, no longer lie in individual development, but in the policy of the state, which is thrust upon the individual from outside and consists in the execution of an abstract idea which ultimately tends to attract all life to itself. The individual is increasingly deprived of the moral decision as to how he should live his own life, and instead is ruled, fed, clothed, and educated as a social unit, accommodated in the appropriate housing unit, and amused in accordance with the standards that give pleasure and satisfaction to the masses. Apart from agglomerations, a huge masses of people, in which the individual disappears anyway, one of the chief factors responsible for psychological mass-mindedness is a scientific rationalism, which robs the individual of his foundations and dignity. As a social unit, he has lost his individuality and become a mere abstract number in the Bureau of Statistics. He can only play the role of an interchangeable unit of infinitesimal importance. Looked at rationally and from outside, that is exactly what he is, and from this point of view it seems positively absurd to go on talking about the value of meaning of the individual. Indeed, one can hardly imagine how one ever came to endow individual human life with so much dignity when the truth to the contrary is as plain as the palm of your hand. I think these quotes also answer why Tolstoy is so adamant about these differences in perspective on country life and on groups of people. He understood that there was something off about viewing people in that way. Tolstoy was much like Levin and probably interacted with lots of Sergeis in his life. I also really loved how Tolstoy made a point of showing that Levin couldn't win arguments with this perspective. He just has to sit there and listen to his brother, thinking that he understands the world and that he can then solve it. Alright, bit of Jung for you. Very, very Jungian. yeah, the whole... Oh, man. I don't know. I don't care. I don't care about Jung anymore. Maybe I did once. Maybe I don't anymore. Maybe I just don't understand it. Maybe I'm too dumb for Jung. Maybe that's what's happening. When I try to read things like that, my brain just goes like, what's in the fridge? And I'm like, the goal of meaning individual life, which is the only real life, no longer lie in the individual development, but the policy of the state. And my brain's just like, the fridge, though. What's in the fridge? You could get food from it and eat it. Food. That's about the extent of my brain power currently. I am hungry. Saying that. Let's read the next chapter. Part 3, Chapter 2. Not Chapter 37. At the beginning of June, Levin's old nurse and housekeeper, Agatha Mikhailovna, happened to slip as she was carrying to the cellar a jar of mushrooms which she had just pickled and sprained her wrist. A talkative young medical man who had only just qualified and been appointed doctor for the Zemstvo district arrived, examined the hand, said it was not sprained, and enjoyed a talk with the celebrated Sergius Ivanovich Koznishev. He told him all the gossip of the district to show off the enlightened views and complained of the unsatisfactory conditions prevailing there. Koznishev listened attentively, asked questions, and, enlivened by the presence of a new listener, became quite chatty, made some pointed and weighty remarks, respectfully appreciated by the young doctor, and reached that state of animation his brother so well knew, which generally followed a brilliant and lively conversation. After the doctor's departure, Koznishev felt inclined to go to the river with his fishing rod. He was fond of angling, and seemed proud to be able to like such a stupid occupation. Konstantin, who was obliged to go to the cornfields and meadows, offered to give his brother a lift in his trap. It was just the time of year, the turning point of summer, when the result of that year's harvest became obscured, when the autumn sowings have to be considered, and when the hay harvest is close at hand, when the grey-green rye waves its formed but as yet not swollen ears lightly in the wind, when the green oats, with irregular clumps of yellow grass interspersed, stand unevenly on late-sown fields, when the early buckwheat spreads out and hinds the ground, when the fallow land trodden as hard as a stone by the cattle is half-ploughed, with here and there long strips omitted as too hard for the plough, when the smell of dried heaps of manure in the fields mingles with the honeyed perfume of the grasses, and waiting for the scythe, the lowland meadows lie smooth as a lake by the river's banks, showing here and there black heaps of weeded sorrel stalks. It was the time of that short pause before the labour, yearly renewed, of getting in the harvest, which always demands all the peasant's strength for its accomplishment. The promise of the harvest was splendid, the weather clear and hot, and the short night dewy. The brothers had to pass through the forest on their way to the meadows. Koznishev was all the while filled with admiration for the beauty of the thickly leaved forest, and kept pointing out to his brother the old lime trees, looking so dark on the shady side, covered with creamy buds all ready to burst into blossom, all the new shoots sparkling like emeralds on the trees. Konstantin Levin did not like talking or hearing about the beauty of nature. Words seemed to detract from the beauty of what he was looking at. He assented to what his brother said, but could not help thinking of other things. When they emerged from the forest, his attention was arrested at the sight of a fallow field and a hillock. Here and there, yellow with grass or broken up and cut into squares, in some parts speckled with heaps of manure, or even ploughed, a string of carts was moving over the field. Levin counted the carts and was pleased to see that sufficient manure was being brought. At the side of the meadows, his thoughts turned to the hay harvest. The thought of the hay harvest always touched him to the quick. When they reached the meadow, Levin stopped. At the roots of the thick grass, the morning dew still lingered, and Koznishev, afraid of wetting his feet, asked his brother to drive him across the meadow to the willow clump near which perch could be caught. Though Konstantin was loth to crush his grass, he drove across the meadow. The tall grass twined softly about the wheels and the horse's legs, leaving seeds on the wet spokes and hubs. Koznishev sat down by the willows, while Levin led away his horse, and having tethered it, stepped into the immense grey-green sea of grass, so dense that the wind could not ruffle it. In the meadow, which was flooded every spring, the silky grass, now scattering seeds, reached almost to his waist. When Konstantin Levin had passed right across the meadow and reached the road, he met an old man with a swollen eye carrying a swarm of bees in a skep. "Have you found it, Fomich?" he asked. "Found it indeed, Konstantin Dmitrich. I only hope not to lose my own. This is the second time a swarm has got away, but it's only thanks to those lads there that I have got this one back." They were ploughing for you and harnessed a horse and galloped after it. Well, Fomich, what do you think? Shall we begin mowing or wait a little? Oh, well, our custom is to wait till St. Peter's Day. But you always mow earlier. Why not, God willing? The grass is fine. There will be more room for the cattle. And what do you think of the weather? That's God's business. Perhaps the weather will keep fine too. Levin went back to his brother. Though he had caught nothing, Koznishev did not feel bored and seemed in the best of spirits. Levin saw that he had been roused by his conversation with the doctor and wanted to have a talk. Levin, on the contrary, was impatient to get home in order to give orders about hiring the mowers on the morrow and to decide about the hay harvest, which greatly occupied his mind. Well, let's go, said he. Where's the hurry? Let's sit here a little. How wet you are. Though nothing bites, it's pleasant. Hunting and similar sports are good because they bring one in touch with nature. How lovely this steel-coloured water is, said he. And these grassy banks always remind me of that riddle, you know, the grass says to the water, we will shake, we will shake. I don't know that riddle, replied Levin in a dull tone. Alrighty. There we go, another chapter down. Have your say about this chapter over at the subreddit. I think we might have some guest readings in the next couple of days, so that's something to look forward to. Thanks for listening. I will see you tomorrow.